Earth, fire, air, water. Long ago, in the early days of the Chuntai era, Avatar Korra helped the peoples of our world find a new balance among themselves. We learned that with our hearts and minds working together, we could create wonders unimagined by our ancestors in both the spirit and material worlds. But all that changed when we discovered the world beyond the veil. We found a culture so different but complementary to our own, and through them came to realize that though our accomplishments were great, they were but the first footsteps on the shores of a much larger galaxy. I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios present Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra, Book 5, Veil. Epilogue, A New Galactic Age, by Philip Jeremy Moyer. Read by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Part 1, An Unexpected Tea Time. Tsintisan, GUA 12, 271 ASC. Wednesday, September 12th, Standard Year 2390. In the spirit world, there was a mountain. Around that mountain, there was a plain. On that plain, there was a tea shop. And in front of that tea shop, there was a table. An assortment of spirits were gathered around the table, sharing in the excellent spirit tea and cakes spread about its wide surface. The conversation was light and jovial, encouraged by the proprietor as he bustled between the guests. A pleasant afternoon, shared by enjoyable company, and even the heightened debate between two of the guests could not dampen the mood. Considering that one of those guests was Avatar Korra, this was a very good thing for all involved. "Well, look," Korra commented, as she blew across the surface of the teacup in her hands. "It's not like this is unprecedented. Remember the Kvald migration of 05? We didn't even know what those were until we asked the Zupangi. Frankly, I'm surprised you guys didn't have them popping up earlier." Across from her, an Ai-Ai spirit gave Korra a gimlet-eyed gaze as he stirred his own cup. "It's not the existence of them that's the problem, Stinky," he replied before taking a sip. "It's just that they get into the strangest places, and they're so... "Weird?" Korra offered. "No, sharp," Ai-Ai replied, and then jumped in alarm as one of the subjects of his concern crawled up over his shoulder. "Ah, see what I mean?" Korra laughed and reached over to take the centipede-like spirit into her hands, lifting it off Ai-Ai's shoulder. "Aw, he's cute," she exclaimed as she stroked the metal scales of the mechanical insectoid spirit. It made a soft, buzzing, trilling sound as it blinked its faceted eyes, and then crawled up her arm on its multitude of tiny wire legs. "See? There's nothing to be afraid of, Ai-Ai. He's different, but not dangerous."
"Hmm,"
Ai-Ai replied, dubious. "Just you wait, Stinky. Next thing we know, we'll have creatures of tubes and wires crawling about the oasis, and if they're not careful, they'll short out, and rust, and stink up the waters." "Sounds like you do care," Korra commented with a sly smile as she sipped her tea. Meanwhile, the mechanical spirit had crawled up to her hair and curled up, making a shining circlet on her head. "Look, if it'll make you feel better, I'll go and talk with them, see what arrangements can be made. Maybe they just need an oasis of their own. Something with an oil bath."
Perhaps, Ai-Ai conceded, before taking another swig of his tea. He then sighed and leaned back in his chair. "It wasn't like this back in the old days." Korra arched an eyebrow. "Yes, and the days of the lion turtles were ever so peaceful." Aye-Aye snorted.
"Can I get the two of you refills?" asked the proprietor as he came up between them with a kindly smile. "I heartily recommend the jasmine blend."
"Oh, thanks, Iroh." Cora thanked the aged tea master with a smile as she held up her teacup to be filled. She inhaled the aroma of the spirit tea before taking another sip.
"Wow, this is really good. Did you use the teapot for this?"
"No, not this time, Cora,"
Iroh replied as he poured another cup for Aye-Aye.
"This one is a special blend taught to me by the radish spirit."
He always did have good taste," Aye-Aye admitted. "I do wonder what he's been getting up to these days."
"Last I checked, he'd set up shop at Jasmine Dragon Corporate Headquarters," Cora replied with a grin and a glance at Iroh. The former Dragon of the West chuckled.
"Ah, it's good to know that tea appreciation has continued into the modern day, even if the prices have changed some since my time."
Cora laughed.
"Anyway, I think in the long run, the spirit world can only benefit from this. All the new concepts coming in from Zipang and Dicho as we modernize, well, it'll just add more variety to the spirits that live here. Stasis may be comfortable, but it kills in the end. Makes you more vulnerable to the things that can change."
Iroh nodded sagely and set his tea tray aside on the table between them.
"The secret of change is to focus all of your energy, not on fighting the old, but building on the new."
Aye-Aye rubbed a knuckle against his sharp chin as he thought it over.
"All right, those are both good points," he finally said, before taking a bite of spirit cake.
Cora smiled and was about to respond, when something on the edge of her perception gave her pause. She turned to look over where Naga and her pack had been resting, well, save for Amaruk, who had been stalking a dragonfly rabbit spirit without much success, and made to get up from her chair. At that moment, everything changed. A sudden hot wind blew around High Rio Peak and across the plain, bending the spirit grass so much that it seemed to flatten outright. Naga's pack went on the alert, howling disconsolately at the sky, which had abandoned its pastel hues for an utter starless black. But they could barely be heard over the terrible, thunderous roar that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere at all. At the wind and the noise, Cora staggered, falling to her knees, clutching at her head with a wordless cry of alarm. Startled, the metal spirit jumped from her hair and landed on the table, where it skittered away to hide beneath the pastry basket.
"Cora!"
Iroh and Aye-Aye exclaimed together, dropping what they were holding and moving to either side of her.
"Are you all right, Cora?"
asked Iroh over the noise as he rested a hand on her shoulder, and she groaned and steadied herself.
"I don't know. Maybe?"
Cora muttered, shaking her head to clear it.
"Here, drink this,"
Aye-Aye added, handing her his cup of tea. She inhaled the aroma deeply, then took two great gulps of the jasmine blend. Her vision clearing, she straightened up and handed back the teacup to Aye-Aye. As she did so, a thought occurred to her, and she glanced at the spirit.
"Wait, did you just call me Cora?"
Aye-Aye rolled his eyes. "I don't know what you're talking about, Stinky." Iroh gave the two of them an amused look, then turned serious.
"Cora, what do you want us to do?"
Cora looked between her two friends.
"Get everyone you can to the spirit portals. I have no idea how long this will last, but in case of the worst..."
Iroh and Aye-Aye nodded.
"We understand," the spirit replied. "Go."
Without further discussion, Cora put fingers to mouth and let out a piercing whistle, cutting through the continuing noise. Naga immediately stopped her howling and ran up to Cora's side.
In one smooth motion, she pulled herself up onto Naga's back, and they were off. Part 2. The Cosmic Null. Time, distance, and direction were all fluid concepts within the spirit world. While time itself was guaranteed to move forward, the rate at which it moved was highly variable and largely dependent on the people experiencing it. The same could be said for places in the spirit world. While concrete locations existed, their position and distance relative to one another were often interchangeable and dictated by the needs and emotional state of the traveler. When that traveler was a very focused avatar, said times and distances were very inconsequential indeed. The Taijitu upon which the spirit portals and the Tree of Time resided appeared mostly unchanged during the brief moment of transition. It was only when the spirit world snapped back into focus that she could see that it was faring the same as the land around Iroh's tea shop. The bare branches of the tree were being stirred by the hot wind. Korra could not recall the branches having moved, ever, not in her very eventful lifetime, or those of her predecessors. The sky here was that spare, starless black as well, the only lights available those provided by the land and water itself, and those in front of the small outbuildings that had been set up over the years on the periphery. Korra paid them little mind as she and Naga came to a halt at the roots of the great tree. A small group of monks and sages had gathered at the base, mendicants and researchers who had taken to meditating near the tree to gain a glimmer of cosmic awareness. Now they huddled together for their own protection, as well as several spirits who had been in the vicinity at the time.
"Avatar Korra, what's going on?"
cried out one of the monks, an airbender named Shespa, one of Rohan's many descendants.
"I don't know, but I'm going to find out. Get everybody else out of here."
She gestured towards the spirit portals.
"Never mind me, just go,"
she exclaimed when hesitancy crossed their features.
"I'll be all right,
I hope," she didn't add as she twitched Naga's reins. The polar bear dog leapt and climbed over the twisted roots in record time, and in moments they were perched on the rim of the opening leading to the hollow trunk. Outside, the hot wind continued to howl, cutting across the opening and causing a deep basso roar to resonate through the tree. Korra grimaced and put the unpleasant memories that came to mind behind her. With a gesture to Naga, she moved to the center of the hollow's floor, assumed the lotus position, took a deep breath, and closed her eyes. The path was there. The path was there, and Korra stood on it. That was perhaps the only good news that Korra could come up with as she meditated and tried to bridge her consciousness to the energy of the universe. The path was there, wide and shimmering, but there was nothing there for it to lead to. What had happened? Even if, by some bizarre circumstance, her cosmic self was not present, the background energy of the universe should have been there. The sum totality of the universe, alive in all its glory, should have been present, observable, a living, breathing thing of stars and worlds, as her own admittedly limited human mind would have interpreted it. This, though, was nothingness, absent of energy or decay, which had an energy all its own. This was totally outside of any of her past lives' experiences. Korra could feel the shock and confusion murmuring in the back of her mind through her connections, shock at the totality of nothingness, confusion as to how any of this could have come to pass. She somehow knew, deep in her soul, that asking any of her predecessors as Avatar what had happened would be fruitless. Even with their 10,000 years of service, that was an eye blink when compared to the universe itself. Korra focused herself inward to the very core of her being. There was one who could possibly help, but even if not, she must be warned.
"Rava."
"Yes, Korra," answered her other half, the light spirit that was bonded to her in ways that transcended the physical or spiritual.
I see it too.
What happened? Cora asked in a wordless plea.
The spirit world's gone bleak, and now this nothingness.
I do not know, Rava admitted with regret. Even when I was independent so many cycles ago, or entwined with Vatu, I have never seen such a thing. This is not darkness, this is absence. I would not have even thought it possible.
But the universe had to have a beginning, right?
Perhaps, but even then it would have likely been birthed from the death of another, Rava mused. Even so, my existence and Vatu's would have begun long after that event. I have no memory of a before for comparison.
Cora grimaced, uttering a wordless, voiceless expletive.
So, this is it, then? The end of the world as we know it?
Her expression then hardened, her resolve strengthening.
Not on my watch. There was a brief moment of amusement from the Avatar spirit.
My sentiments exactly, Cora, she replied.
Whatever happens, I am with you. Forever.
I know, Rava. Cora answered fondly as she gathered herself.
Thank you.
With that, the Avatar threw all her focus, all her will, and all herself into invoking the Avatar state. She could feel the rush of power begin as Rava and her past lives, from Aang to Wan, joined with her, and then, with a suddenness like a light switch being turned on, the energy of the cosmos returned. No fanfare, no premonition, no warning. Just emptiness one moment and existence the next.
Cora blinked glowing eyes and would have rubbed them if she had thought to do so in her bogglement.
Well, that was easier than I thought, eh?
She paused in her self-congratulation to study the situation further. Yes, it appeared that the universe had somehow returned, but the whole thing seemed off, somehow. Like a television image suffused with subtle static, something was preventing the cosmic energy from returning to its full strength.
Okay, spoke too soon, she remarked to herself, and shifted her focus.
Now, instead of looking inward, she looked outward, past her cosmic self to the universe beyond. What she found surprised her. When she had perceived the infinite before, joined in meditation by others, or by herself within the Tree of Time, she had not sensed any particular intelligence behind it. If there was one, it had been vast and unfathomable, beyond even the great spirits and their workings. But now there was something to be sensed. She couldn't define it exactly, but a presence was definitely there. For some reason she couldn't describe, it strongly reminded her of her long-deceased mother. Whatever, whoever, was behind this latest change in the universe, she could tell that it was not malicious, but caring. Even so, she could somehow tell that the presence was strained to its limit. That somehow it was responsible for the restoration of the universe, in a last desperate measure to prevent the end of all existence, and that it couldn't keep it up forever. Cora's heart and mind went out to the presence, offering to help in any way that she could. The answer she received was one of wordless reassurance, a promise that the universe would go on. The emotions contained within that promise were almost overwhelming in their totality, and the Avatar had to fight to keep from flinching. Steeling her resolve, Cora answered that response with a promise of her own, that she would stay with the presence as long as it was required, until the universe was fully restored. Her promise was backed up by that of Rava and her past lives, all the way back to the first Avatar, the Avatar spirit in totality providing whatever assistance it could. Time became undefinable as Korra existed in that state of connection, synchronized with such an intelligence. It was a strange form of communion, of a type in which she had never participated before. She couldn't tell if progress was being made or not, or if her efforts were making any difference. She only knew just that her support was deeply appreciated, and was making the whole endeavor more bearable for the presence on the other side. A sudden surge in the cosmic background energy snapped the Avatar out of her trance. With something like a muted gasp hiccup, the presence's own energy was subsumed by that of the rest of the universe. Korra reached out with her mind and spirit to help the presence recover, but now she could only feel contentment and satisfaction from the entity, that of a job well done. The static was gone from her perception of the universe. If anything, it seemed even more real than before. While she was still processing that, there came one final emotion from the presence before it faded, the closest to dialogue that Korra had so far experienced with it. Thank you. With a wordless "you're welcome," Korra withdrew from the contact. She had done all that she could at this level of reality. Now it was time to deal with the ones closer to home. Korra came back to herself, still seated within the depths of the Tree of Time, and took a deep breath. She let it out with a sigh, uncoiled herself from the lotus position, and walked over to Naga, who had waited patiently near her master. "Good girl," Korra said as she rubbed the polar bear dog behind the ears. As she did so, she could hear that the horrendous noise from earlier had stopped. The pastel lights of the sky shone through the trunk's opening, illuminating the interior. This was a promising sign, but there was no telling how the spirit world had weathered the storm otherwise. With a resigned sigh, Korra climbed back out to the roots of the tree. From her vantage points, she could see that the area around the portals had not survived the incident unscathed. Several of the outlying booths had collapsed, and the spirit water channels had broken their banks in several places, causing irregular pools to form among the ridges of the Taijitu. What was most notable, however, was the large gathering of spirits and humans that had formed beneath the Tree of Time. Mixed together without regard for role or species, this group had apparently disregarded her earlier warnings, or had gathered here after the incident to find out what had just happened, which Korra thought more likely. "Well, can't be helped," the Avatar remarked to herself. "Time to deal with it," she admitted with a self-deprecating smile before putting her game face on and hopping down to address the group. The confused, concerned muttering from the crowd picked up as they noticed that Korra had emerged from the tree, but they quieted almost immediately as she raised her arms and waved to get their attention. "Excuse me. Hello? May I have your attention, please?" Korra called out to those assembled. Once she saw that their attention was on her, she took a brief moment to size up the crowd. There were quite a few familiar faces there, and she nodded in satisfaction. "Thank you. First off, it would appear that the universe has not ended," the Avatar started without preamble. "There was a brief period of interruption, for lack of a better word, but some other power took steps to rectify the situation, and I aided them with the restoration. Whoever or whatever it is not hostile." A pudgy spirit frog grunted. "What's that supposed to mean?" "It means that I believe the worst is over for the time being," Korra replied. "Whoever is responsible for the restoration has promised that the universe will go on, and I am inclined to believe them." She held up her hands to forestall complaints before any arguments could begin. "What I need all of you to do right now is to return to your homes, take stock of what damage may have occurred, and then report back to the Air Acolytes and Nomads who will be remaining here.
That way we can determine what's happened and we can prioritize how and when to fix things.
Murmurs of discussion began to spread within the assembled crowd, and Cora raised her voice again.
I promise you, you will not be abandoned in the aftermath of this crisis. We will work together to fix this, spirit and human alike. Look to your neighbors for help, and we will all get through this.
As the conversations began to turn more positive, Cora gestured for one of the air nomads to come closer.
Will you take care of coordination on this side for me, Shespa?
She asked the airbender as she approached, followed by one of the fox-like knowledge-seeker spirits that roamed the spirit and material worlds.
Of course, Avatar Cora.
The spirit researcher answered with a nod, which was matched by a nod from the fox spirit next to her.
We'll take care of things here, and I'll report back to Grandfather as often as I can.
Good. Thanks, the Avatar replied as she gave Naga a scratch behind the ears.
Let me know immediately if anything stranger than normal comes up.
Of course. Cora took one last look around the Taijitu as the crowd began to break up to check on their home territories. She sighed and gave Naga one last hug before releasing her.
Take care, okay? I'll be back.
The polar bear dog gave her longtime master a friendly lick on the cheek, then settled back on her haunches. Cora nodded, closed her eyes, and focused. With another breath, Cora left the spiritual world for the physical one. Cora slowly blinked her eyes open, feeling her spirit settle back within her body on Air Temple Island. As she returned her focus to the concerns of the material world, blurry shapes of crimson and saffron resolved themselves into a small group of air acolytes and nomads surrounding her. Seeing that the Avatar had returned to her mortal shell, they moved forward to provide assistance if she needed it. The Avatar waved off their offers of help, remaining seated, searching the small crowd surrounding her in the ocean-facing meditation pavilion for one person in particular.
"Where's Jinora?"
she asked through dry lips.
"I'm here, Cora," came the reply from the elderly master airbender as she stepped through the small grouping of acolytes. "You had us worried there for a while."
Cora made a noncommittal grunt and finally accepted one of the acolytes' offers of water. She took a deep drink to soothe her dried throat and then looked up at Jinora as she waited.
"So, you know?"
Jinora nodded gravely, reaching a hand up to pet the green dragonfly bunny spirit that had perched on her shoulder.
"The gist of the matter, but not the specifics. Furryfoot and his friends were quite worried, and they weren't even in the spirit world at the time."
Cora took another drink of water and frowned.
"If the spirits out here could sense it,
damn.
What do you want us to do, Cora?"
The Avatar thought this over for a few moments, looking down at her glass of water. Then she lifted her head, looked Jinora in the eye, and issued a single, simple directive.
"Summon the White Lotus."
Part 3. The Other Side of the Divide. Friday, September 14th, Standard Year 2390. Sintiu, GUA 14, 271 ASC. Saikyo, Zipang, Enigma Sector. At first glance, Foreign Minister Hayashi's job wasn't all that complicated. The original settlers of Zipang, hailing from such first- and second-generation Japan-derived colonies as Tomodachi and Hayaku, had specifically chosen their new colony's location in the Enigma Sector in order to get back to relative basics. No high-traffic space lanes, no galactic megacorporations, no major rare resources to draw the attention of any hostile galactic powers. The Zipanki liked their privacy, choosing for themselves what they would allow past the borders to integrate into their society. When Genom made its push for galactic dominance in the wake of the fall of the Wedge Defense Force, the reaction from Zipang had been to close down all of its border orbital stations, save one. While perhaps not all that effective in the galactic view, a planet's surface is a rather large area to interdict from orbit, especially for a newly established third-stage colony. It was more that the effort was made that counted. So, on paper, the position of Zipang's Minister of Foreign Affairs didn't actually have much to do. All official trade and immigration was managed through Dejima Station, in geosynchronous orbit above Psykyo. Zipang's Space Navy was mostly geared toward intrasystem defense and orbital interdiction. The chances of them needing to enforce foreign policy outside the system was slim to none. What diplomats that Zipang had were dispatched toward various of the Enigma, Rigel, Cygnus, and Centaurus sector polities that respected Zipang's neutral stance on matters interstellar. For any other galactic power, this would have made a posting to the Foreign Affairs Office either a retirement home for government officials past their prime, or a source of busy work for those up-and-comers who had more energy than political sense. Those galactic powers, however, didn't have a Class 5 multinational urban and industrial inhabited world on the other side of a metaphysical divide from their own colonized planet, one much larger in population and overall capability than their own. So they could be forgiven for underestimating the amount of effort the foreign minister had to actually put into the job. Fortunately for Zipang, Hayashi Midori was not the kind of woman to let things slide. Straight out of college, Hayashi had not let her homeworld's self-imposed isolation stop her from satisfying her interest in foreign cultures. Fresh-faced and bright-eyed, she had joined the country's foreign service, dispatched as an aide to one of the diplomats assigned to Decho's United Republic of Nations. 2 decades later, after a few lucky breaks, 3 duels, and a lot of hard work, Minister Hayashi now wore the haori jacket of a government samurai, occupied the largest corner office in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and kept her naginata of office finely honed. Even if she didn't get out into the field as often anymore, she kept tabs on her officials and the international affairs of her country and its neighbors, in both directions, with a precise and steady hand. For instance, on this day, Hayashi was going over the minutes forwarded to her from the colony's representative in the Federation Senate on the current debate over the Earth Alliance's proposed legislation for psionics monitoring, while also drafting a proposal for increased training of Zipangi-born element benders in association with the components of the United Republic's military. It wouldn't do for her home to go unprotected, however the Federation ended up actually deciding on the issue. "It's just my luck that the Inner Colony Caucus would push this nonsense through on my watch," the minister muttered to herself as she read the latest report, detailing how several of the Co-Prosperity Sphere's representatives had spoken vociferously for the need to monitor the emergence of random psionic talents. I bet Kome would never have put up with this when he was in office. I don't know. Minister Kato always complained about the Earth Kingdom Parliament stonewalling him whenever he didn't think I was listening. Hayashi's eyebrows went up beneath her glasses as she looked up from her data terminal. There in the doorway stood a familiar form, grinning crookedly as she leaned against the doorframe, arms crossed. Avatar Korra. Korra smiled, giving the minister a quick water tribe bow. "I'm afraid this isn't a pleasure call, Midori." "Of course, of course," Hayashi replied, getting up from behind her desk to give the avatar a formal bow of welcome. "So what brings you to my doorstep today?" "Has there been anything
strange going on in the outer galaxy the past few weeks? You mean other than the Federation Parliament still debating over this Psi-Corps initiative the Earth Alliance has come up with? Cora shook her head. Not anything that long-term, within the past week or so. Well, my contacts in the Navy have reported on a burst of traffic on the Rigel Terminus Corridor. Not cargo haulers, but something a lot more heavily armed. How long ago was this? Specifically, between last Wednesday and this Tuesday. Within the past week, we've had quite the eclectic array of transports passing by the system. They all filed their flight plans, and we had no cause to stop them, since they weren't planning to linger in our orbital space. But still, the Free Spacers, Genom Corporation, WDF, various free traders and couriers, it's not exactly a unified group. Well, the timing sort of works out, though I don't see how spaceships going back and forth would influence what happened in the spirit world. We've had plenty of them fly by in centuries past, even if we didn't know it. I'm afraid that aspect is far outside of my expertise, Cora. Hayashi then tilted her head, curious. What did happen, if I might ask? I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. It just seems like the universe stopped, for lack of a better word, but then started back up again. I'd never seen anything like it. Just then, one of the agency's functionaries poked his head in, a data pad in hand. Minister Hayashi, we've got an update from Orbital Traffic Control. Ah, good. Put it up on the screen, if you would. Hayashi and Cora turned, and the decorative screen along one wall changed images from a Hokusai reproduction to a diagram of the nearby sector. Although a lot of the diagram's details went over Cora's head, she could read the lines and labels well enough, and the aggregation of tracked spacecraft did appear to be traveling along the corridor the minister had mentioned. However, while the tracks entered through the Rigel side, they did not make it all the way through to the terminus. Instead, they stopped halfway through, and within the past day started going back out the way they came. The nearest astronomical feature to their stop point was indicated with a large label, Enigma X-21. Hayashi blinked. That can't be right. Has this data been verified? Yes, Minister, by the head of traffic control himself. Cora studied the diagram, and her brow furrowed. She turned and looked at the minister with concern. Now, I'm no astrophysicist, but I thought getting too close to a black hole and back out again was impossible. Hayashi frowned and came to a decision. Bring my car around. We need to get to the spaceport right away. Yes, Minister. The trip from the Foreign Minister's office to the spaceport's orbital traffic control station was a 15-minute ride for a Ministry hover car, carrying the driver, the Minister, the Avatar, and their respective protective escorts. While neither official really required one, it was a political token that had served them well, and you never knew when you'd need backup to take out some hostile element to one's person. As such, the four of them traded anecdotes about their years of service on the drive over. So, if you can believe it, the Terra Triad decided just then to get into a brawl with the police outside the Fire Nation Embassy while Hayashi here was visiting on the behalf of the Zipang Ambassador. Cora explained to her Kyoshi warrior escort and the minister's foreign service bodyguard, who were listening with rapt attention. Unfortunately, they decided to do it just as she was getting out of the ministry's Sato-mobile. Really, you make it sound like I held off the triad members by myself with nothing but my wit, charm, and blade-handling skills, Hayashi replied with modesty. I did have help from the embassy staff, she continued, with an acknowledging nod to the face-painted woman in combat fatigue seated next to Cora. I knew my cousin was stationed for a time at the Fire Nation Embassy, but she never mentioned this, the Kyoshi warrior said with quiet awe. She always compared the job to a whole lot of standing around, being imposing, and trying not to fall asleep. The minister chuckled and nodded. Well, Maya was always one to understate things. Speaking of which, Jin, has there been any word? Oh, yes, the warrior said with a grin as she sat back. She finally gave birth last month. She had a girl. They've named her Maki. Hayashi nodded. A good, strong name, that, she said with approval. I'll need to send a congratulatory gift basket from the embassy for this auspicious occasion. You know, Minister, I'm surprised, said her bodyguard. With your history, I would have expected you to join the warriors, not just train with them for several years during your posting to Kyoshi Island. Hayashi shrugged. Well, as much as I enjoyed my time there, dealing with the Unagi proved to be too much of a hassle. I'd rather face politicians and the triads.
Zipang's central spaceport stood out from the rest of Saikyo's urban infrastructure due to the fact that it had changed very little from the colony's early settlement days. Large enough to handle cargo haulers and orbital transports to and from Dejima Station, but not large enough to receive the long-distance passenger liners and heavy industrial transports that were in vogue elsewhere in the galaxy. The landing field was surrounded by the blocky reinforced prefabs and revetments that were ubiquitous to first-stage colonies across the settled galaxy. The only concession to the colony's unique architectural idiom was the passenger terminal's front facade, which to Korra's eye looked like a Fire Nation community center. The interior, however, was a purely utilitarian passenger concourse, more generic than some of the ones in airports back home, and Korra kept her momentary disappointment from showing as they were ushered to the spaceport's more functional, non-public areas. She tried hard not to look too bored as she was led through a number of nondescript prefabricated hallways, and only visibly perked up again when they arrived at the spaceport's control center. Minister Hayashi, Avatar Korra, thank you for coming, said the director in charge of Zipang's air and space traffic control, as he welcomed the four into the center's observation office. I take it you want to know more about the report the Orbital Traffic Office sent over.
That's about the size of it, Korra replied, crossing her arms. The whole thing looks strange, and I know strange.
Hayashi nodded.
What are your findings, Hiranuma?
The director nodded, straightening his haori of office before moving to his desk to activate the controls for his master status display. The diagram the two women had seen in the foreign minister's office reappeared, much larger and more detailed than before. The activity on the Rigel Terminus corridor first came to my attention when the Genom Star Destroyer Vindicator logged their flight plan to pass by our system on the way to the terminus. Now, as you can imagine, even with Genom being on the up and up these days, a super star destroyer doesn't go anywhere without some direct orders from the higher-ups in the company. Although they passed us by without incident, I had several of my people keep track of where they were going, just in case we'd have some blowback coming the other direction. Hiranuma gestured toward the diagram, at the tracks that would lead ships through the corridor to places in the terminus such as Omega and Zelfina Station. However, it never came out the other side. A Super Star Destroyer disappeared? Asked Hayashi's bodyguard with surprise. Hiranuma nodded and ran his hand through his graying hair. For 3 days there was no report at all. And then yesterday, the Genom ship comes back, going the other way. Long-range sensors in the system picked up some major battle damage on its hull, and while they were as nice as you please responding to our request for another flight plan, they were rather silent about what they'd been up to. That's when you started having other people look into any other disappearances, Cora postulated. The director nodded. Correct, Avatar. In the past week, 12 ships of varying tonnages and battle capacity have traveled the corridor, dropped off the radar, and then shown up again. Whatever happened out there, it was big. So, how'd you find out where they'd gone? Asked Korra's escort. Hiranuma gestured at the display, changing the images projected therein. Once we realized that these disappearances were occurring, a Tiger team of our controllers began going through the long-range sensor logs, the ones that are used by the deep space observatories, and they started to notice a pattern. Spots of light appeared in a cluster in one particular system. A collection of hyperspace warp and reflex fold traces in the Enigma X-21 system, and even that new metaspace drive that's been announced, all of them stopping just outside the event horizon of a black hole. I can see why you'd be concerned, Korra replied with a frown that matched the one on the flight director's face. Especially with this damage, she continued, pointing to some report displays on the side. They look like they've been through the ringer. I can't even recognize the causes of half that damage, Hayashi's bodyguard spoke up once again. That's like carbon scoring, but the scale of it. No battle big enough to cause that kind of damage would go unnoticed in a core sector, even Enigma. We'd have heard about it from all the news outlets by now. Hiranuma arched an eyebrow. You've got a good eye, Mr. Ibu, sir. Ibu Tadayuki. Hayashi smiled slightly. Mr. Ibu served a tour in the Navy in order to pay his way through his degree. The flight director chuckled. Well, when you get done working for the Foreign Ministry, you might want to come over here instead. You honor me, sir. I'll need to think about it. Of course. Korra looked out through the windows of the observation gallery, watching the traffic controllers at work below. It was a room filled with organized chaos and quiet tension, one that reminded her strongly of missions past. Before she could start getting maudlin, a commotion at one of the terminals caught her attention. As she turned to point it out to the group, the voice of the floor supervisor issued from the flight director's desk. Sir, we've got another one. A minute later, Korra, Minister Hayashi, and Director Hiranuma were gathered behind the controller's station. As the flight controller continued to monitor the information, Hiranuma was consulting with the floor supervisor. Which one is this? One of the late arrivals, the Phoenix Queen. She doesn't appear to have suffered major damage, he said, gesturing toward the sleek starship displayed on the controller's side monitor. Whatever happened, they appear to have avoided the brunt of it. Sir, they'll be in range for contact in 2 minutes. Do we just let them pass? Their incoming report was pretty rushed, according to the controller on duty, said the seated controller, indicating a flight plan record from earlier that week. We could call them, ask for further clarification. Before the supervisor or Hiranuma could reply, Korra spoke up. Here, let me take this one. Pardon? The controller looked back at her boss and her boss's boss. When they nodded, she got out of her chair to make way for the Avatar. Thanks, Korra replied, and then plucked the cap off the controller's head and put it on her own. Gotta look official, she said with a slight grin as she settled herself into the console. She squinted briefly, committing the salient facts of the courier ship to her mind, and then put on her best being cheerfully polite face before opening the video channel. Hello, hunting vessel PQ9-613. This is Zipong Orbital Control. Please state your cargo and destination. Oh, hi, Zipong, answered a pretty brown-haired woman. Veronica Santangelo here. Captain Inazuma's racked out. It's like 2 in the morning for us. She smiled indulgently, trying to suppress a yawn as she did so. "No cargo. We're a survey ship this month. Just on our way back to New Avalon from charting the terminus for the WDF OSC. Cora nodded and made as if to log that destination into the computer. "Our plot shows you passed near Enigma X-21 not long ago. Did you encounter any anomalies there?" Veronica blinked, then shook her head. "Huh? Nope. Well, unless you count the big honkin' black hole, but, you know, it's pretty clearly marked. And hey, you don't bother them, they don't bother you, right?" she added with a shrug. Cora arched an eyebrow. "I see. Anything else? Unexpected traffic, unusual comms, anything out of the ordinary at all?" "No, not so much. Everything's pretty quiet. But then, we used up all our Class 10 probes on this trip, so we wouldn't know anything about anything beyond sensor range anyway." Veronica grinned. "We're just heading home to get paid, get laid, and recharge the milkshake machine." "Right. Well, clear skies, Phoenix Queen. Zipong out." Veronica smiled and nodded. "Thank you kindly, Zipong. Phoenix Queen out." With that, the connection was terminated, and the group watched as the courier's marker disappeared from Zipong's local traffic pattern as it left the system. Cora regarded the display for several long moments, muttered an "Uh-huh," then slowly turned around in her seat to look up at the minister and their joint entourage. After a moment's consideration, Jin spoke up. "It's not really my place to say, Avatar, but that was remarkably suspicious. Especially since they never made it to the terminus in the first place." Cora frowned and got out of the controller's seat, handing her back her hat as she resumed her station. "Something's not right here." "I agree, Avatar," replied Hiranuma. "I suppose they didn't consider the range of our long-range sensors in creating their story." Cora nodded, and then looked over at Hayashi, who had an expression of grim determination, one hand resting on the collapsed staff of her sheathed naginata. "Midori?" The minister blinked, and then looked over at the Avatar. "My apologies, Cora." She shook her head, frowning. "This entire matter is troubling in several aspects. We clearly need more information if we're to determine if it's related to the matter you came here to discuss, which is seeming more likely by the second. I promise you full cooperation of my agency with the White Lotus Society, Avatar Cora. Zipong's best interests are served by participating in a joint investigation of the events of these past weeks." Cora smiled. "Thank you, Minister Hayashi. And I'll keep trying to figure out what happened on my end and fix anything that was broken because of it. Hopefully, between the two of us, we'll be able to make some sense out of the whole deal."